It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Kevin McKinley is with me, and it's time for On Your Money. Kevin is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us this morning from WPR's Eau Claire studios, and he wants to know, what's your personal finance question? You can ask it at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kevin, good morning. Good to talk to you again. I haven't talked to you for quite a while.
Hello, John.
Okay. Kevin, over the past few weeks, you've been offering up tips for certain ages and stages. Where do we stand today? What ages are we talking about this morning?
Well, this being our final On Your Money show, John, over the last couple of weeks, as I'm sure you've heard, because I know you're a regular listener, you're one of the three who tune in every week.
and one of your two Facebook friends,
that's
too.
Right. I lost the other one. Yeah. I don't know what I said. But no, what we've been doing is we've been talking about different financial moves and rules of thumbs for people at different ages and stages. And we addressed the younger and the middle-aged people in the previous weeks. This week, we are going to talk about those who are either ready to retire or who are already retired and want to remain that way. We're going to talk about figuring out how much you need to retire comfortably and then how much you can spend in retirement, regardless of your situation. And then later on, we'll also talk about finding an advisor, whether or not you should or need long-term care insurance, and Social Security, when to take it. Some of the most oft-asked questions over these 600 and some odd episodes.
Okay. Well, that's a lot to cover, so let's get to it. Let's start by figuring out how much money you need to retire.
Yeah, right. We and John, you've gone through retirement, correct?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, and yet you're back.
And yet here I am.
Not very good at it.
No, I'm not bad as a radio host, according to some
people. No, you're just not a good retiree.
I'm not a very good retiree, no.
Yeah, what we like to use is actually a figure that doesn't have anything to do with your income or your assets. But what I'd rather predicate retirement on is your monthly spending, because even though it's difficult to control it, it's still more controllable than investment returns or what type of pension or Social Security you're going to get. So to figure out how much money you need to retire, first take your monthly spending in retirement and then subtract any Social Security and pension payments you expect to receive, and then multiply that figure by the months of retirement, meaning your life expectancy in months, and that's how much money you will have needed to accumulate to see if you actually are financially ready to retire.
Clearly, I thought I was going to die next week.
Shoot, it didn't work out according to plan.
I may die before the end of the show. So that sounds pretty simple, but a lot of people struggle with that.
Yeah, let's say you're spending $5,000 a month in retirement, but you're also planning on getting $3,000 per month in Social Security and or a pension payment. That $5,000 minus $3,000 leaves $2,000 that you need to cover from savings and investments. And if you expect your retirement, unlike you, John, to last another 20 years, that's 240 months. So you take 240 times that $2,000 deficit. That gives you about $480,000 that you would need in savings and investments to retire comfortably in this scenario.
I can see I'm going to have to raise my rates as a call-in talk show host. What about figuring out how much we can spend once we are actually retired?
Well, then you can actually just reverse the process and take your lump sum and divide it by the amount of months you have left to live in your estimation, and that's how much you can spend this month, again, plus your Social Security and pension. So if you have $100,000, you expect to live 100 more months, you can spend $1,000 this month, and then you can do the same calculation next month to figure out how much to spend that month.
So, I mean, trying to figure out how long you're going to live, it's easy to say on the radio, but I mean, are there actuarial tables, because life insurance companies use them. How long can we expect to live, and is there any kind of rule of thumb for how many months you really have to plan for practically?
Right. 85 is the number I usually use for men, and 90 for for women. But of course, that can be different. But that's a good rule of thumb that I like to use. And people wonder about the age difference in that. It reminds me of the story of the there was a study that was released that said that single women vastly outlive married women, but married men vastly outlive single men. And so when I proposed to my wife and I bought a relatively expensive engagement ring for her, I gave it to her and I said, "This is compensation for the life that I'm going to suck out of you."
And she married you anyway?
And she did anyway, right. Wow, and I've held true to that.
You know, that's an amazing story. Okay, hang on a second. I got to make the lawyers happy here. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their own financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. It's On Your Money on the Ideas Network. You can call in and ask your personal finance question. 800-642-1234. You'd think the number of times I've said that number, I'd get it right. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. And we've already got callers. Let's start with Perry, who calls us today from Milwaukee. Perry, thanks for joining us on Your Money. What's your question for Kevin?
Yeah, good morning. Last year, my wife and I are both retired. And last year, we set up a giving account with Fidelity Financial. And I began funding it last year with a taxable account, which, of course, creates a tax event. And I'm going to be doing the same thing this year. Now, in the future, what I would like to do is use an RMD from our regular IRA in order to fund that account. And if I understand correctly, I don't have to wait until I'm fully 70 and a half. I can start drawing an RMD at the beginning of the year I turn 70 and a half. And I was wondering, Kevin, if you could clarify that.
Yeah, it's a tricky rule, Perry. And what it means is that you have to take a distribution from your retirement account, from most retirement accounts, by April 1st of the year after you turn 70 and a half. And it's your first mandatory distribution. That's why they call it RMDs, the required minimum distributions. But then you have to take another one if you wait until April 1st, later that calendar year. But if you actually take, the reason the April 1st number is in there is because a lot of people, when they first put this in, were forgetting to take it out because it was their first one. They weren't used to it. And so they put a kind of a grace period of December 31st to April 1st to give you another chance to take it out without a penalty. But if you took one out in the previous year for at least the RMD required amount that's determined by IRS tables, that will qualify as the RMD in that particular year. So let's say you're 70 and a half right now, and you take a distribution from your IRA. You have to take one this year, but that's your one. And then next year, you have to take another one for it. But it will qualify in the year in which you turn 70 and a half.
Perry, thanks so much for your call. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Your personal finance questions for Kevin McKinley on Your Money. Let's go next to William in Fond du Lac. William, welcome to On Your Money. What's your question for Kevin?
Hello, Kevin and John. I broke the rule of using my Roth IRA money for my dependent daughter's college. And as my taxable income has not gone up, the grants and loans have become less through the FAFSA program. I'm wondering if that's correct, where they use tax-free money or if they only depend on doing forms with taxable income.
Okay, so William, you're paying for your child's college education, and some of the money you used to pay for that was the distribution from a Roth IRA, correct?
Correct.
Okay, I don't mind that, and especially if you're already comfortable retiring with what you have and you can afford to use it, I think it's any port in a storm. You have to use all kinds of different resources to pay from college. The bad news is, though, even if you pull money from an IRA, And it's not a taxable distribution because it's a tax-free distribution, like Roth IRAs often are after you're age 59 and a half. It still goes on the FAFSA form, which is the federal financial aid form, as income to be included in what's known as the EFC. That's the expected family contribution. Now, it probably wasn't a drastic drop, but it can affect the amount of need-based aid that is awarded. And so for people out there who are in this situation, if you can, you may want to delay those distributions before you fill out the FAFSA for the final year, and meaning the kid's senior year, and then take the distribution out. Because if they're not going to be applying for financial aid the next year, then that distribution won't affect need-based aid. Or on the other side of it, if you can do this without too much in the way of taxes or penalties, take the distributions out a couple years before the kid actually is going to be applying for financial aid. And then that also will show up as a parent asset. But it won't show up as income. And usually income is hit at a higher rate in the expected family contribution than parent assets are.
William, thanks so much for your call. 800-642-1234. Join the program On Your Money today with Kevin McKinley. You can send an email to ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go next to Art in Milwaukee. Art, good morning. Welcome to On Your Money.
Hello, Kevin. We will miss your regular Tuesday morning show. But,
thank you, Art.
I'm of retirement age. A number of years ago, we put for several years money in I-bonds at your recommendation, which is fine. But I'm wondering, you know, we had pretty low inflation rates and kind of low yields, I think. So what's the current interest rate, if you know, in I-bonds, and what do you think or recommend this in terms of going forward as an investment?
Great. Thank you, Art. And I'm you get what you deserve for following my advice. I think Series I savings bonds are a fantastic investment then and still now. What they are, for people who aren't familiar with them, is they're the savings bonds that where the I stands for inflation and means that technically the interest rate is tied to the consumer price index. And every 6 months, every May 1st and November 1st, the interest rate is adjusted according to the previous period's inflation figures. And right now they pay 2.52% for bonds issued between May 1st and October 31st of 2018. And the reason I like these so much is, you know, 2.52% is a very competitive rate for something that's relatively liquid. And these I-bonds are relatively liquid. You shouldn't put money in there that you're probably going to need within a year because it's tough to get it out within the first year. But after you've held them for a year, you can pull them out and there is only 3 months worth of interest penalty for early withdrawal. And if you keep them in there 5 years, there's no penalty at all. And the interest is exempt from state taxes. So if you live in a state with a higher income tax tax bracket, there's an extra savings above other types of investments like CDs. And best of all, you can choose when to declare the interest on those bonds. You can let it roll in and defer until you actually cash them in, or you can declare the interest every single year and pay taxes on it, even though you're technically not pulling it out. So you can manipulate your philosophy on paying the taxes according to your situation. So I like them. The bad news is you can only buy $10,000 per person per year, and you have to go online to buy them at treasurydirect.gov. That's treasurydirect.gov. It's kind of a tricky process to set up an account and get it established, but once you're into it, it's pretty straightforward. And I think it's a good idea for people who have some extra cash. Maybe they don't want to lock up a CD very long, or they like the idea of deferring the interest taxation, to look at those Series I savings bonds. Again, treasurydirect.gov, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Thanks, Art, for your question. And lines are open right now. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, now's the time to call in. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Still to come On Your Money, we're going to talk some more about when is the best time to start taking your Social Security. And that's all yet to come. But right now, we'd like you to call in with your personal finance question, 800-642-1234. It's On Your Money with Kevin McKinley, financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. is the morning show. I'm John Munson, and it's On Your Money with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is the financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he wants to answer your personal finance questions today. Call us at 800-642-1234. Lines are full right now, so why don't you try firing off an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kevin, we've got, we've got a lot of lines are full right now. So let's take Jim in Milwaukee first. Jim, go ahead. You're on the air. Good morning. Welcome to On Your Money.
Hi, Kevin. My question for you is my wife recently retired, and we pulled about $400,000 out of her 401k and just put it into a money market, figuring, well, you know, we're not going to make anything on it, but we're not going to lose anything on it. And that would be our first go-to money to use. We cashed out her pension, took the lump sum, and we're going to invest, you know, most of that in very as conservative as we can. I guess my question, you know, is how much would you feel comfortable? I guess the $400,000, I'm thinking if we took $50,000 out a year for 8 years, at least we're not making anything on it, but we're not losing anything on it. And it's just become that broken record of health care of where that's going for when I would retire in the next year or two.
Right. Yeah. And I can understand your apprehension, Jim, and especially when you retire, when you're on the cusp of retirement. I actually think it's a good idea to err on the side of caution with your investing and be even more conservative than you otherwise would have been while you were working and saving or as you retire and spend down the road, because it is actually traumatic for some people to retire, because financially, I mean, they're giving up a paycheck. But for people who usually can afford to retire, oftentimes they were so into their work that it became part of their identity. And when they are retired, they don't have that part of their identity more. They don't have that purpose anymore when they get up. And so you can't go on Facebook or on Wisconsin Public Radio and say, I have $400,000 in my health and I'm relatively happily married, but I'm stressed out about this, of what to do with this money and making this change in healthcare. But it still exists. And so it's good to acknowledge that and just understand that it takes about a year or so usually for people to transition from working and saving to retiring and spending and be comfortable with it. Now, I actually kind of like your $400,000 as saying, well, if I have $50,000 a year that I need to spend, I can. This will last for 8 years, because it's a kind of a pessimistic attitude. But as I've learned in life, if you lower your expectations enough, you'll never be disappointed. So what I'd like to see you do, if that's your goal, Jim, is to, rather than just keeping in the money market, which, by the way, based on new rules, money market accounts can actually lose money. Not a lot, but the dollar value can fluctuate, kind of like a mutual fund. And if it's not FDIC insured, there's a chance that the value can decline. And especially in a low interest rate environment, you usually are better off looking for other things out there. And the good news is for people who've kept money in the money market is that interest rates have risen lately to the point where you can start getting a competitive return on safe investments. And in your specific situation, Jim, what you might want to do is put that $400,000 in $50,000 CDs that are maturing each year sequentially over the 8 years. Now, it's still going to be, you know, basically your principal that you're spending if you do choose to spend this, but you will earn, let's say on average, about 2%, and maybe in the further end CDs, over 3% on that. Well, if you average 2% on that return, that's an extra $1,000 a year per CD that you will be earning. And over the 8 year time period you're referring to, that could be $20,000 or $25,000 of extra interest. And again, if you get CDs at a local bank, you can pull out the longer term ones, usually with only a small penalty for early withdrawal. So I like the idea of staying conservative. I also like the idea of taking the pension in a lump sum versus the ongoing payments. So I think you're good with it. You might want to leave a little bit in stocks just to get some longer-term growth. But if you don't need the growth, then don't take the risk.
Jim, thanks for your call. Let's go next to Tom, who's calling us from near Oconomowoc. Tom, thanks for joining us on Your Money.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Lately, I have seen and heard advertisements for, in particular, I think it's called the Alliance for Lifetime Income Security or something like that. And essentially, it seems like it's a clearinghouse for annuities. And I already have two annuities totaling about $150,000. And I just wondered what Kevin thought of that situation where I have about $95,000 in CDs. And the annuities would pay somewhat more, and another annuity would pay somewhat more. But I understand that the downstroke for the investment guy is a pretty good chunk of change for the opening an annuity.
Right. I'm not a big fan, as again, both the longtime listeners of On Your Money know, I'm not a big fan of annuities. The expenses are huge, and as you, I'm glad you're aware, Tom, because sometimes very bright people have come to me and said, well, I bought this annuity and there was no commission. The guy who sold it to me said he didn't earn anything for it. And I said, you know, was he a monk or what? Was he some kind of Buddhist who had taken a vow of poverty? Because that's really impressive that he would work with you, set up this contract, and do it all for no money. And the fact of it is he or she actually earns a ton of money from it. Annuities pay 6% commission in many cases on the initial investment. And so if you put $100,000 into an annuity, the so-called advisor and the firm he or she works for will get $6,000 of your money. And then what happens is there's usually a surrender charge. So if you pull the money out within the first 8 to 10 years, they take a big chunk out of it to reimburse the money that the insurance company borrowed to pay that big commission chunk. And then during the time that you have it in there, if you don't take it out, the expenses are very high. And part of the reason the expenses are high is because, again, the insurance company has to make payments on the money that they borrowed to make the commission payment for it. Now, if you're comfortable with that, and then you're also comfortable with the risk of handing your money over in a lifetime income annuity to some company and thinking and knowing and hoping that they will be there for you every single month when they promise to make you a payment, I'm okay with it. Personally, I'm not comfortable with it for myself. I'm not comfortable with it for people who are retiring. I'd actually rather just bury the money in the hole in the ground and pull it out than hand it over to some company, because at least then I know where the money is and I can get at it any time if I need to spend it or I need to invest it elsewhere. But when you give it to the insurance company, if they invest it safely, they're not going to make much return. Therefore, they're just going to basically give your principal back. And if they invest aggressively to try to get a higher rate of return, it makes it less likely that they're going to be able to meet their obligations.
Thanks, Tom, for your question. Let's take a quick call from Austin, who's calling us from Woodman. Austin, go ahead. You're on your money.
Hi, I'm 36 years old, and the company I work for does an age-based retirement plan, if you don't know anything about it, like I don't. So, high risk because of my age and then some secure things there. But like last year, I did really well from what I could see. I have like $140,000 in 9 years of employment there. But then I hear that, well, it's not aggressive enough because of my age. And I guess I don't know. It's through Empower. And you have the option of hiring someone, this or that. I just wondered your thoughts on if you stay with the program, is it sufficient?
Sure, Austin. And first of all, great start to be 36 and have $140,000 set aside. Now, you have had the wind at your back for the last 10 years or so for investments. Investments have generally done very well. But good for you, because that's a great start. The 2050 fund to which you are referring means that for people who plan on retiring in 2050, the fund starts out relatively aggressive with a big portion of its money in stock mutual funds. And then as every year goes by, drawing closer to the year 2050, the overall allocation of the fund generally gets more conservative, with a little bit more in bonds in the money market and then a little less in the stock funds. And for most people, that's usually pretty good, and that's usually the way it works. Now, just because it's going into bond funds at some point doesn't mean the bond funds can't go down in value. In fact, I think one of the big untalked about risks out there, or lesser discussed risks, is the bond market, and especially bond mutual funds. But with that said, I think it's okay, and especially if you're still contributing to it, even if it goes down in value, that's good, because your contributions or your employer's contributions going into it are buying more shares at lower prices. And so if it bugs you to have some volatility,
see if there's a more conservative option in there. I'm almost sure there is. But if not, I think that's a good way to do it rather than try to manage it yourself and guess about the ups and downs and just say, well, I don't need this money today. I really can't take it out without a big penalty for 25 years. So I'm just going to allow it to be relatively aggressively invested, and I'm not going to look at it until I get closer to retirement.
Austin, good luck on with that, and hopefully you'll cash in 2050. 800-642-1234, that's the number to call to join On Your Money. You can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Speaking of emails, a number of listeners, Kevin, have sent in emails asking, how can I find a good financial advisor?
Yeah, it becomes a lot more urgent, John, as you near retirement. And there are a couple different ways you can get help. One is just a one-time checkup, which just allows you to see kind of where you are, gives one person's opinion on if you're ready to retire and any late-stage changes you might want to make. The other one, of course, is ongoing advice and management, and usually it's fee-based. The best way to do it is just to ask around at first if you have friends or family members or professionals like bankers or your CPA, accountant, tax preparer, anybody you know is kind of in the business, basically sits down at a computer and really doesn't actually do work all day. Ask them and say, do you know financial advisors or financial planners I should talk to? And hopefully you can find the right person that way, or at least someone who geographically is nearby and you can sit down face to face with.
So what if that process doesn't produce any candidates for me?
Now, you can start looking locally, or you can go online. There are plenty of websites that give you financial planners like NAPFA, letsmakeaplan.org, plannersearch.org. We'll have links to all these search engines up at onyourmoney.com later on today. And you can, of course, you know, look in the Yellow Pages and see all those. There's be 20 different financial service firms within most major metropolitan areas. And then once you find someone, ask them and say, do you specialize in my particular situation? What can I expect from you as part of our relationship, both at the beginning and ongoing? How much does this cost, and how do you get paid? Because it's very important that you know what their financial motivations are for recommending certain investments and hopefully helping you out.
So going into the local tavern and asking the first three guys you meet what you ought to do is probably not...
Or skip those three guys and go right back to that well-lit machine with the cherries on it right there and just start plunking your retirement savings in there.
You know, I see right now where I went wrong. Okay, well, speaking of getting paid, that's been a big issue in the financial services industry.
Sure. For several years, they've been talking about the fiduciary rule, which would require all people offering advice on retirement accounts, but ostensibly all investments, to act in the client's best interest by putting the client's needs first ahead of the advisor's. And the analogy I use is you go to your mechanic and you say, I need all new brakes on my car. They're squeaking. And the mechanic takes a look at it and says, no, you don't need new brakes. All you need is new pads and just on the front. So instead of paying me $800, you pay me $200. That's what you want from just about every advisory service you get, whether it's money or cars or whatever. But it wasn't a rule until the Obama administration put it in, and then it's been rolled back by Trump and the Republicans, where they are changing it to say you still only have to offer advice that's suitable. Now, that said, there are still many hundreds of thousands of advisors who are fiduciaries. And if you're talking with someone, you can ask them and say, are you a fiduciary? Are you legally required to put my interests ahead of yours? And if you're not, why aren't you willing to adhere to that particular standard? Now, just because you have a fiduciary doesn't mean that person is the best person in the world. And just because you're not working with a fiduciary doesn't mean the person with whom you're working is the worst person in the world. But it is a way to kind of separate people and say, what kind of motivations are going to be driving the financial advice I get.
All right, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And you can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings, 800-642-1234. Kevin, listeners often ask you, when should I take Social Security? What's your answer?
Yeah, it's an easy question. All you have to do is you tell me when you are going to die, and I will tell you when to take Social Security. And if you're a single worker, you're not married, and you're just working based on your own earnings, there are about 96 possible different months in which you could take your retirement Social Security benefits from 62 to 70. But if you are married, there are over 8,000 permutations if you both have earnings on which Social Security is based. And so the break-even point is usually about 80 years of age. So if you think you're going to live to 80, it it's probably better to wait to take Social Security, whether you're 62 or 69. And if you don't think you're going to make it that long, then it's better off to take it today.
So again, you know, this whole thing rests on how long am I going to live? So it's kind of like a roulette wheel situation.
Yeah, that's right.
Then.
Yeah. That's right. And then you die.
Put your money on 29 black. Okay, yeah. There it goes. Yeah, was nice while we had it. Okay. There's got to be some good rules of thumb to consider here, aren't there?
Right. It's better to take Social Security than it is to spend your savings, because if you spend all of your savings, then you have no more flexibility. Yes, you might have a slightly higher Social Security check, but you have no rainy day fund to spend, to invest, to help anybody out who needs your help or to donate. And it allows you to keep total control over your assets. So as a rule of thumb, if you can, try to wait at least until full retirement age, which depending on when you were born is about 66 or 67.
Okay. So hang on, I'm making a note. Start rainy day fund now.
Got it. I'm okay. So glad you showed up today, John. You're
man,
really
I am too. I'm
a
just
lot of getting, benefit from
I'm,
this.
You know, this is great. You know, whatever. Why is 66 the magic number? Why is that age important?
Because if you reach full retirement age before taking Social Security, you don't have any reduction in benefits if you have outside earned income. So if you still have your job or part-time work or whatever, that income won't reduce your benefits. And more importantly, if you are married, one spouse can file if you both reach full retirement age, and the other one can then file for spousal benefits, getting a partial check based on the filing spouse's earnings, and let his or her own benefits increase until 70. Now, again, even if you employ all these different strategies you can use to enhance the benefits, you generally still have to live to 80 to make waiting worthwhile. So, again, the basic rule of thumb is it's okay to wait to take Social Security if you don't have to start exhausting your savings.
All right, 800-642-1234, the number to call for On Your Money. Let's take another call before we go to our break. We'll go to Gloria, who's calling from Milwaukee. Gloria, good morning. Welcome to On Your Money. What's your question for Kevin?
Yes, I have a question about EE bonds. If they have expired and they're not giving interest anymore, and you don't cash them in the proper year, in other words, you find them another year or two later, is there a penalty when you put that interest on your taxes?
John, wasn't E.E. Bonds the poet who didn't capitalize?
No, that was E.E. Cummings.
E.E. Cummings, right, E.E. Yeah. Bonds. Okay, well, first of all, Gloria, for the double E bonds, when they stop earning interest, under the rule of the law, the government says at that point, even if you don't cash the bond in, you have to declare the interest and pay it on your taxes. Now, as far as I know, no one has ever been arrested for waiting to declare that. But if you're audited, the government might say, why didn't you declare the interest in this particular year and pay taxes on it? But you probably have maybe a 1 in 200 chance of getting audited. And even then, they probably would say, hey, you might have a minor penalty or something. And then in the following year, you actually paid the tax out. But I'm sure there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people out there who have savings bonds that have stopped earning interest and haven't been cashed in, and the people haven't declared the taxes. So that part about it, I'm not worried about it. But once you do cash them in, then you definitely have to declare the interest and pay taxes on it.
Gloria, thanks for your call. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join us on Your Money. We'll take a short break and we'll be back with more personal financial advice from Kevin McKinley. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're in our last On Your Money segment here for this Tuesday. And Kevin McKinley is here. He's financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. ready to answer your personal finance questions at 800-642-1234. Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Steve in Madison. Steve, you're with Kevin on Your Money.
Good morning. Yes, first of all, I wanted to give Kevin some true thanks, some true praise.
Thank you very much.
The question I have, though, is I'm 70 and a half. I've already taken an amount equal to my RMD this year. What I would like to do is to take some more money out of my IRA, and I understand that if I pay that money back into my IRA before the end of the year, then I don't have to pay taxes on it. Is that true?
No. Do you have earnings? Well, first of all, thank you for the true praise. Second of all, do you have earnings like of that you have salary or wages?
No. Okay. I'm retired.
Okay, then you cannot make contributions back to an IRA. What you may be thinking of is you can take money out of your IRA and you can move it to your Roth IRA if you want. But whatever amount you move that's above and beyond your RMD, you can't make your RMD contribution to your Roth IRA, but you can move money above and beyond that to a Roth IRA. But when you do that, Steve, that income will be counted as taxable income. So the bad news is you're going to pay taxes on it. Now, you may not pay very much on it because your income may be low. You may have losses or whatever. But once it's in the Roth IRA, then there's no mandatory distribution on Roth IRAs while you're alive. But you can always pull it back out whenever you want, basically, with no taxes on it at all because you've already paid the taxes on it. So if you think that you can bump up your distributions from the IRA and still stay below the 12% federal income tax bracket, which is about $50,000 of gross income for a single filer, and $100,000 for married couples filing jointly, that could be a good idea because it may mean that you have lower distributions down the road and instead you're paying a little bit more in taxes right now.
Steve, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Patrick in Wisconsin Rapids. Patrick, you're on Your Money with Kevin McKinley.
Hi, good morning. I've got a couple of questions about 403Bs. My wife and I are looking to invest more in our retirement's trying to catch up, and we found there's lots of families that sell 403B products, and each family or each sales company has like 15 to 30 mutual funds in it, but they all seem to be heavily managed funds with lots of fees and high PE ratios, and it's very confusing. Any tips for the novice investor?
Right. Well, that's one of the bane of public employees is many of them are still subject to 403B plans, which were created generally by insurance companies and are still, those insurance companies kind of have a lock on the market, especially for smaller plans. And they're usually don't have a charge to get in, nor do they have a charge to pull the money out if you retire or move the money around. But they do have very high internal expenses. That's how the company and the guy in a tie, as they say, or the woman wearing the nice business suit who shows up once a year gets paid, is because of those high expenses. So, if you contribute more than, say, $5,000 or $6,000 to that plan, which I think you should if you can, that's really your only option. But you can go to the managers of the 403Bs and say, look, you need to offer lower expense plans in here. Now, sometimes the companies like, let's say, Vanguard, that do offer lower expense investment options with index funds in it, they're not willing to serve smaller plans because there's no money in it. And they lose money by offering even the relatively modest advice that they offer because the expenses are so low. But you should still encourage the people making the decision on which 403B provider to use to try to find one that offers lower expenses, and it might be lower service as well, but that's okay because the plan participants should have that option of saying, I don't want as much service, therefore I don't want to pay the expenses.
Patrick, thanks for your question for Kevin. 800-642-1234. There are lines available and time available for you to call with your personal fans question for Kevin McKinley, just like Patrick and so many others have done this morning. We'll take a call next from Tyler, who is in Madison. Tyler, thanks for joining us. It's On Your Money. You're on with Kevin McKinley.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My wife and I both contributed to our Roth IRA for the 2018 year, and my wife receives commission for her job, and it, we're luckily, it looks like we're going to go over the married joint filing limit for a Roth IRA, but we already contributed to it. Is there some sort of penalty we'd receive if our like combined income is too high?
And I'm sorry, this was for the 2018 tax year, right, Tyler?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, you're actually in pretty good shape. Just call the provider up wherever you made the contribution, tell them your situation, and it's not too late to back it out. What happens that could create a problem is the longer you leave it in there, if you get audited and they find out that you weren't eligible to make that contribution, they can hit you with taxes on the earnings plus a penalty for every year it was left in there, and it can eat up a lot of the account. So you want to do this sooner rather than later, and you want to contact the provider and say, this is a very common mistake, by the way, and it's a good problem to have. I mean, having too much income is a good problem to have. If other people out there are listening and have done the same thing, it's worth it to pay an actual CPA to help you back out, at least for this particular tax year, while he or she also prepares your taxes, because it's really tricky to do it. There's a lot of work involved with it, and it's easy to make a mistake while you're trying to fix the previous mistake, which, of course, compounds the problem.
Tyler, good luck with that. I'm making another note here. Having a lot of income is a good thing.
Okay. I know. 600 shows, and I never thought to bring that up.
You know, you're a genius. Huh? What can I say?
I know. I'm writing this down as it comes out of my mouth.
Yeah, write that down. Yes. Have more money. That fixes. Well, you know, I spent some time working in the retail grocery industry in between low-paying radio gigs, and the motto there is volume cures everything.
Same thing in radio.
Yeah, right. Same thing in radio. Yeah, so if I get louder, it must mean I'm smarter. So speaking of smarter, let's have some of your thoughts on long-term care insurance.
Again, one of the oft-asked questions here over these many years. If you have long-term care insurance, you should keep it, even as they are increasing your premiums, especially if you can still afford it. But if you don't have it, you probably can't afford it, and you may not need it. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, only about 35% of retirees are going to go into the nursing home at some point in their life. A recent study from the RAND Corporation said that number is higher. It's a little over half of the people, because what's happening apparently is more people are being discharged from hospitals and into nursing homes because the care, the rehabilitative care, is a little bit cheaper there. But again, you're looking at maybe a 50-50 proposition of going to the nursing home. And again, according to the RAND Corporation, the average stay is about 272 nights, but that works out to about 9 months. And, you know, that in a really high-skill facility, that can add up to $100,000. But again, this RAND Corporation study said that only about 5% of insured people will spend more than $50,000 out-of-pocket on long-term care costs.
Well, that's still a lot of money, and the insurance would help cover that.
Yeah, it would. And again, that's why I say if you do have it, please try to keep it and hang on to it, because it's always cheaper to keep the insurance policy you have rather than trying to replace it with a new one. But if you can, you keep it as premiums rise. That's a big question. And then, of course, we've already addressed, will you need it? And the answer is probably not. And then finally, there's a bigger question about, will the insurance company you've signed up with be willing to pay? A lot of insurance companies have underpriced their policies, meaning they don't charge enough in premiums, even though it seems expensive, so that they may have difficulty paying for the nursing home care experience down the road, and you might be left in the lurch. You might say, well, why did I pay in all these years? And they say, well, you were covered for all those years. If you'd gone in when you were 71, we would have paid for that year. Now that you're 85, we just aren't able to pay for it anymore. Now, that's an unlikely development, but it's still possible out there, and the longer people live, the more likely it is that the insurance companies will have a tougher time meeting their obligations.
What are the alternatives to long-term care insurance?
You know, some of the smartest, most conservative people I know and work with in my grown-up job have actually looked at the numbers and said, you know what I'm going to do? Rather than send $300 to some insurance company every month and hope that they're going to be there to if and when I need this money, I'm going to slide $300 into a bank account. And if I do it every single month and it lasts, you know, over 20 years, let's say, I'll have $60,000 or $70,000 saved up in that bank account 20 years from now. And in the meantime, if I need the money for something else, or I pass away without needing long-term care, someone I care about will get that money, and the insurance company doesn't get to keep it. You also have to remember, if you're getting long-term care, by definition, you are alive, and therefore you will still be receiving Social Security and hopefully any monthly pension payments you qualified for. And then finally, you may have some assets left, and if you're a homeowner, you may have a house that by definition you don't need likely anymore because you're going to be in the nursing home. So that house can be sold and to pay for it. If you sell a house that's worth $200,000 20 years from now, that should cover at least 2 or 3 years of care.
Speaking of Social Security, we had a caller, Kent from Reedstown, who called. He's concerned about possible cuts to Social Security and is wondering whether he should file sooner because of that.
He sure can. You know, Social Security is still running a surplus in most years. They have about $2.5 trillion with a TR built up in that surplus. And, of course, if things go as according to projections, that surplus will run out and then things will switch off to just kind of a pay-as-you-go, where workers coming in will pay people who are retired for it. And the Social Security Administration estimates that at that time, about 75% of benefits will be covered. I think that's a possibility. I think tweaks will be made to slightly lower benefits and slightly raise taxes to help offset that doomsday scenario. So I wouldn't use the possible depletion of Social Security as a reason to take it. I'd rather do it for the reasons they say. If you don't think you're going to live to 80, or if you just want to take it and it feels good to have a new check coming in every single month, then take it.
Okay. Well, let's get one more call in here. Rick in Oconomowoc, please be brief because we're almost out of time.
Okay. I'm 58 years old, and my company offered a voluntary separation plan where they're going to pay me a year and a half of my wages, including benefits. I'll be 59 and a half when it's all said and done. And I want to know, as they're not contributing to my 401k anymore, can I still take some of my money and put it into an IRA or a Roth IRA?
Yeah, as long as you have earned income in the year in question. So if you made money and you can use that to base the contribution on, yes, you can add it to an IRA or Roth. And depending on which is better, it depends on several factors, one of which is whether or not you're qualified to make a tax-deductible contribution to the IRA. And if you're not, you're better off going with the Roth. And we have a link, Rick, up at the IRS.gov website that'll tell you if you are qualified based on your earnings.
Rick, thanks so much for your call to On Your Money today on the Ideas Network. And Kevin, what's our website of the week?
Well, this is one we've referred to already today. It's called onyourmoney.com, John, and it's actually our own website for the show. And even though the show is going off the air as of today, we are still going to be putting up content there, and we will be answering questions there. We'll have links to archives of the shows. If you get bored and you want to go back and listen to something from 2007, you can. OnYourMoney.com. So visit that in the future if you'd like to keep in touch.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Thanks, Kevin. And here's a note. Today is the last time you'll hear On Your Money as a regular hour-long segment. Personal finance is incredibly important, and it's a priority for the Ideas Network. We'll have more conversations with Kevin in the future here on The Morning Show and across the Ideas Network. They just won't be weekly at this time. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. On Your Money is heard on the Ideas Network, or has been heard on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy. Brianne Chasso is also one of our producers. So is Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Butina is executive producer. It takes a village to make a talk show. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.